Georgia is on the mind of many people today as a hand recount of ballots has been ordered and key political operatives are already in the Peach State to focus on the two January Senate runoff elections. Good afternoon. I'm Pedro Echevarria. It's November 11th, and this is Washington Today. More on that in a moment. In other news, President-elect Joe Biden's popular vote total now is over 5 million votes more than that of President Trump, according to the Associated Press. The Hill reporting the Trump campaign has filed a lawsuit in a Michigan federal court seeking the state from certifying the final vote count until allegations of irregularities are addressed. The campaign has previously filed a similar lawsuit in Michigan Claims Court where a judge rejected its request. Hurricane Eta weakened again to a tropical storm this afternoon, just hours after regaining hurricane strength as Florida braced for a second hit from the storm nearing the Tampa Bay region. And on this Veterans Day, President Trump held his first public event since last week, a Veterans Day observance at Arlington National Cemetery in Washington, where he made no remarks. President-elect Biden made an appearance at the Korean War Memorial Park in Philadelphia. We turn to Georgia. Georgia Secretary of State announced Wednesday that the state will conduct an audit of the 2020 presidential race by recounting by hand the millions of ballots cast where President-elect Joe Biden is leading. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger's announcement comes as he faced pressure from President Donald Trump's campaign for a recount, calls from fellow Georgia Republicans to resign, and accusations of mismanagement in the election process, according to CNN. Attention has turned to Georgia, where both two high-stakes U.S. Senate races appeared headed for January runoffs and is causing friction among Republicans in the state. Earlier this week, two GOP senators, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, fighting for re-election, demanded Secretary Raffensperger resign from the office, accusing him without evidence of failing to, quote, deliver honest and transparent elections, end quote. Here is Secretary of State Raffensperger from earlier today.
The next step in the current election process is getting the final county certifications in. We'll then move to the Risk Limiting Audit, or RLA. At 1 p.m. today, I will make the official designation of which race will be the subject of the RLA. At that time, I will designate that the RLA will be the presidential race. With the margin being so close, it will require a full, by-hand recount in each county. This will help build confidence. It will be an audit, a recount, and a re-canvass all at once. It will be a heavy lift, but we will work with the counties to get this done in time for our state certification. Many of these workers will be working plenty of overtime. We have all worked hard to bring fair and accurate counts to assure that the will of the voters is reflected in the final count and that every voter will have confidence in the outcome wherever, whether their candidate won or lost.
That was Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger from earlier today. He says he expects the recount to be done in time for Georgia's certification of the presidential results, which has a November 20th deadline. He also said he hopes to start the recount before the week ends. So far, 97 of Georgia's 159 counties have already certified their results, but all of the county certifications are still required by Friday. He also noted a change in the dates for the upcoming runoff elections. Under state law, a Senate candidate needs to hit 50% of the vote to avoid a runoff. Neither of the state's Republican senators, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, reached that cutoff, meaning that both contests will likely go to a runoff on January 5th. Senator Loeffler, who was appointed late last year to fill the seat of retiring Senator Johnny Isaacson, faced multiple candidates in her race, including the Reverend Raphael Warnock, a Democrat, and GOP Republican Doug Collins, depriving her of enough votes to win outright. In the other race, Senator Perdue was sitting under the 50% threshold required to win the November contest against Democratic challenger John Ossoff outright, making it almost certain that the pair will also meet in the January 5th election. Both candidates are already campaigning for the runoff. Here again is the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger.
This is a process. It is a process defined by law. These men and women in my office will continue to follow the law and count every legal vote. As it stands today, 97 counties have sent their final numbers in. The current margin stands at 14,111 between the President and Senator Biden, Vice President Biden. My office will continue to investigate each and every instance of illegal voting, double voting, felon voting, people voting out of state. If you report it, we will investigate it. Every legal vote will count. We will continue to follow and enforce the law. Now let's look at the next steps. We are currently at looking at having a statewide runoff on December 1 and another on January 5th. This is an untenable situation for these men and women to try and run both of these elections. With that, under my powers under the health emergency, I am moving the date of the December 1st election to coincide with the federal runoff on January 5th. This will protect the integrity of both elections and make for better election administration. It has the added benefit of saving taxpayers millions of dollars. The reason we have so many of these on rollover list voters is a direct function of COVID. This is the reality.
The Georgia Secretary of State from earlier today. The first Republican rally for control of the U.S. Senate kicked off on Wednesday in Cobb County with a visit from U.S. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who appealed to suburban conservatives to turn out in January for Republicans Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. The Florida Republican senator spoke to a packed room about the Republican pickups last week and why he thinks that was the case. With more, here's Senator Rubio.
And I have all these people from the national press asking, why did that happen? You know, what happened? What did Republicans do to get the Hispanic vote and so forth? I said, the Democrats that were running are crazy. These are crazy things that they're talking about doing. And normal people don't like crazy things. What do I mean by crazy? This is real crazy. These are crazy things they don't like. They don't think, look, everybody supports the First Amendment. Well, I shouldn't say everybody, but we should all support the First Amendment right to protest. If there's a problem and you don't like it, you have every right in the world to protest. That's a key part of our rights and of our country. You don't have a right to burn down a city. You don't have a right to take over a street. You know, there is no, we forget a week ago at this time, or maybe 8 days ago at this time, the news was filled with stories of major American cities where these businesses were putting up plywood, which is what we do when a hurricane is on the way, but not when an election is on the way. And I assure you, they weren't putting up that plywood because conservatives were going to be upset at the outcome of an election. These are radical elements. These are radical elements. So these people don't like that. These people don't like police brutality. Our men and women in law enforcement are extraordinary human beings. Now, they'll be the first ones to tell you that, like any endeavor that involves human beings, there are people among them that do things that shouldn't be done. But that doesn't mean you get rid of the police department and replace them with social workers. Because if, God forbid, tonight someone breaks into your home and holds your family at gunpoint, you don't want to grief counselor. You don't want somebody there to sort of talk them through it. You want police officers to show up and save your life and your family's life. And so they think defunding the police is crazy. They think it's crazy.
Senator Marco Rubio from earlier today. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quote, Rubio proved a big draw. Hundreds of supporters, many not wearing masks, crowded the cramped headquarters of the Cobb GOP, tucked into a strip mall outside of Marietta. Dozens of reporters and camera crews showed up, too, to capture the first Republican rally of the runoff season. John Ossoff, who launched a socially distanced tour of Georgia on Tuesday, issued a broadside at the Republicans for the crowded rally. He said, the spokesman for John Ossoff said, Jake Best, he called it incredibly dangerous, and that's in quotes, to stage an event in the middle of a worsening pandemic. You can find that article and more on the Georgia runoff election at AJC.com. Still in Georgia, but back to the presidential election, the Georgia Republican Party and U.S. Representative Doug Collins, who is the leading the recount effort in Georgia, spoke on a campaign call saying, quote, the campaign is far from over, end quote. Here's more with Doug Collins.
This is not over. There's legal recourse that is being done all over the country, but specifically here in Georgia. One of the main goals that I've had, and since joining this, to make sure that we look at this recount when we saw that it was going to be close, and we knew that there was a lot of concern about the election and the integrity of our vote, is that we have to understand the very basic principle that every illegal vote suppresses a legal vote, and we don't want to see that happen. What I am very happy to announce is that Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger here in Georgia has agreed with us. We sent a letter yesterday asking that there be a complete hand count of the ballots here in Georgia in all 159 counties. We're glad to report that that has been agreed to. As we go forward, that will take place starting soon. We'll have Stefan here in just a moment walk through that, since it is the first time here in Georgia doing this. What we have to understand is, though, this is about really the first step. This is making sure that every legal vote is counted and every illegal vote not counted. It allows us to see the integrity of the process, and it allows the people on both sides of this, whether it be President Trump, Joe Biden, or anyone else, to say that the election process has been carried out in a thorough way. It is opening up also. It allows us to, again, be looking for the concerns, and we'll talk later, and also looking at this for the issues of ballot harvesting, the issues of, as we go through, the signature matching issues here in Georgia. Those are separate issues, but we'll continue that process. The main thing that I want to emphasize to you today is this is a victory for integrity. This is a victory for transparency. From our campaign's perspective, that we have asked for this, the Secretary of State has agreed to this hand recount, and now the people of Georgia and this nation can see the transparency of an election here in Georgia, and I believe, as it will move forward, we'll show the results of many of this election in a way that people can believe in.
That was Representative Doug Collins earlier today on a Trump campaign call about legal challenges to the vote count in Georgia. Now to President-elect Joe Biden and his transition team. Senior counsel for the campaign, Bob Bauer, and Dana Remus, the general counsel for the campaign, spoke on Tuesday with reporters about the Trump team's legal attempts and questioned if they could cause harm to the transition. The campaign legal advisor, Bob Bauer, on Tuesday telling reporters that the president's campaign array of election lawsuits is, quote, noise, not really law, close quote. He pointed out that since Election Day last week, judges have dismissed 7 court cases lodged by the Trump campaign in Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. And he said the Trump campaign cannot win the election based on recounts in any state. From Tuesday, here's Bob Bauer and Dana Remus.
I wanted to ask, Bob, you talked about the theatrics of these moves. Are you at all concerned that the Trump administration is pursuing legal challenges to undermine Biden's transition and presidency? And how would you go about combating that? Go ahead.
There's no question, since they can't overturn the outcome of this election and Joe Biden will be inaugurated on January 20th, 2021, that they are pursuing other, if you will, collateral objectives, and one of which is to attempt to instill in the minds of some portion of the populace that the election was illegitimate, and also to throw obstacles in the path of the government. But the Biden-Harris transition is going forward. It's moving along very briskly. President Biden will take the oath of office on January 20th, 2021. And that's going to be our answer to that. I mean, in the meantime, there'll be theater, but it'll be playing to increasingly light crowds until it empties out completely and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris take their oath of office. But I want to pause for a minute and offer Dana an opportunity to comment as well.
Yeah, I would just add that the Presidential Transition Act, an act of Congress, acknowledges how important the smooth and effective transition between administrations is. It lays out the process for the transition, it ensures that even as the political process is in process producing a winner, that the government must rise above politics and ensure the best interests of the country. And so it has set forth the steps that both campaigns have taken over the summer and take now that we have a president-elect. It governs. We trust that it will guide the steps forward, and it will ensure that the president and president-elect and vice president-elect have everything that they need. As Bob said, they are moving forward. They are preparing to govern. We have absolutely no worry or no doubt that when they take office, they will be ready to go.
That was Dana Remus, general counsel for the Biden campaign. You also heard from Bob Bauer, senior counsel for the Biden campaign. That was on a press call that took place on Tuesday. Another election call today from the AP. President Trump has won the state of Alaska, the Associated Press reporting on Wednesday, days after President-elect Joe Biden won the general White House race. As ballots continue to be counted in the week since election, President Trump won Alaska's three electoral votes. That was expected. The state typically supports Republican presidential candidates, but President Trump's lead in polls had been smaller than usual, with the Republican nominee leading by fewer than 10 points in some recent polls. The electoral votes for the president do not drastically change the current results of the race. The AP and other networks called the presidential race for the president-elect Joe Biden on Saturday. The Electoral College tally, according to the AP, now stands at 290 for Mr. Biden and 217 for President Trump. Also, Alaska Republican Senator Dan Sullivan has won another term. His victory brings the number of Republicans in the Senate to 50. And on the House side, last night the AP called three more House races, including Washington State's 8th District Democratic Representative Kim Schreier, who gives Democrats a majority at 218 in the House for the 117th Congress, which begins in January. Republicans have won 201 House seats, according to the Associated Press. 16 House races remain uncalled, that including Louisiana's 5th, which is headed to a December 5th runoff, with Republican incumbents and candidates leading in almost all of those races. One of the storylines we heard leading up to the election was the role of social media companies, particularly how they monitor political discourse. That's the subject of a story by Emily Glazer, tech and politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She joins us now. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the headline of your story talks about social media companies and the aggressive stance they took. Let's start with that. How would you characterize that?
Social media companies have been doing more and more to regulate political content over the last year or so. But we really saw them pick it up during election week and right beforehand. Twitter took a couple of moves to limit the spread of viral content on its platform in efforts to stop the spread of misinformation. Facebook and Twitter have been making more moves to label posts that might be misleading or false. And we've seen YouTube also make changes to their platforms to downrank content that could be misleading. But it really wasn't until election week where we saw this happening full throttle. Twitter was regularly labeling President Trump's tweets that had inaccurate information about the election. And we saw Facebook even take down some groups on Facebook as well.
What was the justification for the stepped up effort?
Well, tech firms are in a bit of a tough position because there isn't a whole lot of regulation on content moderation. So the tech companies find themselves calling the moves and the shots, and they don't always do it consistently. Because there was a sense that they really wanted to have accurate information out about the U.S. election. And since President Trump had been tweeting for months saying the election was rigged, questioning the legitimacy of mail-in ballots and other measures, there was an effort that these tech companies had to take some matters into their own hands in efforts to try to prevent the spread of misinformation and inaccurate information getting out to their hundreds of millions of users.
One of the things you wrote is that the companies are being put in a position to determine what they believe is true and what is not. In a sense, how comfortable were these companies with that approach?
Not very initially, that's for sure. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has been talking a lot about the free speech and that how that's very important to him. He said that quite frequently. But we saw both him and other tech executives, including Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, consistently speak about the political content on their platforms as it got closer and closer to the U.S. election. And I think it finally hit a turning point in the election week, certainly after the Associated Press and other media outlets called the presidential race for former Vice President Joe Biden, now president-elect. And we've yet to see President Trump concede the race. And so even though for some the election is over, on these social platforms, it is still happening, and they are still trying to figure out what moves they need to make so that their users are getting accurate information.
Well, thanks for the lead up to that, because what's the process now, I guess? Where do they go from here?
Well, we reported today that Facebook and Google plan to continue banning political ads on their platforms for the next several weeks to prevent confusion about election results. That's according to people familiar with the matter in an email that we reviewed. Facebook actually told advertisers in an email Wednesday morning that it would continue the post-election ban on political ads for another month. And I'll just quote, they said, quote, while multiple sources have projected a presidential winner, we still believe it's important to help prevent confusion or abuse on our platform. I might also add that Twitter's measures to limit the spread of virality are still continuing, and our understanding is with Brazil's municipal elections coming up later this month, there are no plans to change those measures just yet. And what I think we're all waiting for is how long these changes that they've made, the platforms have made, specifically around adjusting their algorithms and slowing down the spread of potentially viral information. And it doesn't look like anything is immediate from our reporting, but they're also not necessarily permanent moves because of the resources, the manpower, and the fact that usually these companies take global approaches, and this isn't a global approach right now. It's pretty specific to the U.S. election.
I was going to ask you, when these companies take a look at monitoring this type of content, is it a breakdown equally of human resources and computer algorithms? Does one way outweigh the other? Generally, how does that work?
What a great question. I wish I had a perfect answer for that, but we actually don't know too much because the companies don't share a whole lot about exactly what they're doing on the back end. That's something that a lot of disinformation researchers who are eager to try to measure whether, you know, their labels have much impact or whether slowing down the virality or changing the algorithms, you know, how that works and whether it's helpful or not. And we can't really peek under the hood yet. We did see Facebook put out a post earlier this week where it actually said just 6% of their users' information is political on their platform, and it was the first time folks had seen that. So we get kind of drips and drabs every now and then. Twitter has a little, it does share its API, so researchers can see a little bit more there. But generally, we don't know the specifics of the moves that they're taking and how they work precisely. And so there isn't that much out there for the public or even for researchers who specialize on this topic to see or measure.
So one of the trends stemming from the election in light of what you're talking about is a growth in the interest of the social media site Parler and similar types of sites. What's the interest there? Why is there attention being paid to these sites?
Well, Parler was started about 2 years ago and kind of pitches itself as a free speech platform. We saw folks that were Trump supporters move over there, including a number of Republican lawmakers like Senator Ted Cruz and others earlier this year. And it got even more attention when there was some reporting that President Trump and his campaign had talked about whether they could shift over there, given the additional move that Twitter had been making soon after they started labeling his posts in the middle of this year. So recently, Parler was actually one of the top downloads of free apps that pretty much exploded in the past several days. And at one point a few days ago, the platform was actually down because of so much usage. And so we're seeing a number of people move over to Parler and other fringe social media networks who feel that they are either being censored or that there isn't a natural flow of speech, and they want to be able to say what they want to say and do what they want to do, and find that they might be moving to other platforms to get there. Yeah. However, I would note that these platforms are still a fraction of the size of Facebook and Twitter. They don't have the same security measures, and so there's a lot to be desired still.
There's more to this story, and you can find it online at the Wall Street Journal website. Emily Glazer, who reports on tech and policy issues for that publication, here to join us. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for your input.
Thank you.
During Prime Minister's questions Wednesday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson told members in the House of Commons that his conversations with President-elect Biden was, quote, refreshing and, quote, exciting when discussing matters of transatlantic relations, in particular climate change. Following his response, Labor member Angela Eagle followed up with a question to the prime minister on whether he had advice to President Trump's, quote, refusal to accept the result, close quote. The prime minister didn't answer that question directly, but stressed it was important for the UK to have good relations with the White House. Here's the prime minister.
One of the many merits of the excellent conversation I had yesterday with President-elect Joe Biden was that we were strongly agreed on the need, for the United Kingdom and the United States to stand together, to stick up for our values around the world, to stick up for human rights, to stick up for global free trade, to stick up for NATO, Mr. Speaker, and to work together in the fight against climate change, Mr. Speaker. And it was refreshing, I may say, to have that conversation. I look forward to many more.
Ms. Lurie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister spoke for many of us when he took a call yesterday to congratulate President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris on their emphatic win in the US presidential election. So does the Prime Minister now have any advice for his erstwhile best friend, President Trump, whose continuing refusal to accept the result is both embarrassing for him and dangerous for American democracy?
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I had and have a good relationship with the previous president. I do not resile from that. It is the duty of all British prime ministers to have a good relationship with the White House. But I'm delighted to find the many areas in which the incoming Biden Harris administration is able to make common cause with us. In particular, it was extremely exciting to talk to President-elect Biden about what he wants to do with the COP26 summit next year, Mr. Speaker, in which, as you know, the UK is leading the world in driving down carbon emissions and tackling climate change.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson earlier today in London. You can find the entire broadcast of Prime Minister's Questions on our website at cspan.org. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back. This is Washington Today for November the 11th, 2020. I'm your host, Pedro Echevarria. With coronavirus cases surging in New York and across the country, Governor Andrew Cuomo said on Wednesday that private indoor gatherings statewide would be limited to 10 people and that gyms, bars, and restaurants must close nightly at 10 p.m. The restrictions will take effect Friday, and Governor Cuomo said that local governments will be responsible for enforcing them. The limit on gatherings will apply to private homes. The curfew will apply to bars and restaurants licensed by the state liquor authority, and restaurants can continue to provide takeout after 10 p.m., but only for food. 61,964 people were hospitalized across the country with COVID-19 on Tuesday. That, according to the COVID Tracking Project, a number higher than at any point during the pandemic, including the first peak in the spring. And breaking from its tentative recommendations on mask use thus far, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said on Tuesday that using masks benefits wearers, which is a step beyond the previous declaration that said wearing masks would only protect those around them. Quote, experimental and epidemiological data support community masking to reduce the spread of the virus, the CDC said in a document that details scientific evidence supporting mask use, going on to say individual benefit increases with increasing community mask use. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci on Tuesday reiterating the importance of masks on MSNBC.
You know, timely question, Andrew, because a recent study has just come out literally within the last day or so that has examined all of the data on masks. I mean, obviously, the data of if you put a mask on, you prevent the exhaling of droplets that would infect others. So it's very clear that you are protecting someone and their mask is protecting you. But recent data has now shown that, as a matter of fact, there's also the added benefit to protect you from droplets and virus that's coming your way. So it's a two-way street in that. So the benefit of masks right now, as people examine more and more the data, it's very clear that it is very helpful. And that's the reason why whenever you get the cascade of four or five things that we talk about that we need to do even more so as we get into the cooler months, wearing of masks, keeping physical distance, avoiding crowds, doing things to the extent that you can with the weather, more outdoor than indoor, as well as washing hands. If we just did that consistently as a nation, not some doing it, others not, we will be much better off. You put that together with a vaccine, and as I use it, I say, help is on the way, and vaccine is the help, and it's on the way. If we combine that with public health measures, we will be much better off.
That was Dr. Fauci from yesterday. So exactly how prepared are states to distribute the vaccine once it becomes available? Joining us for that discussion, Isaac Arnsdorf, a reporter for the online publication ProPublica. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the headline to your piece says most states aren't ready to distribute the leading COVID vaccines. Tell us why.
Because it's really, really hard is the short answer. And in particular, this Pfizer vaccine that just had the announcement about its preliminary results and is likely to be first out of the gate is unusually difficult to handle. And that's because of it has to be stored at a very, very low temperature, 100 degrees Fahrenheit below zero. And it's also going to come in these packets of a minimum of 1,000 doses that, because they have to be at that low temperature, then they can only last for a few days. So that's kind of makes sense if you're thinking about like a mass vaccination site in a densely populated place. But when you start to think about trying to get out into more rural places, and particularly in the first round, they're really going to be targeting healthcare workers, you know, how are you going to get through 1,000 vaccines in just a few days at a rural hospital that's miles, an hour's drive down a two-lane road and only has a few dozen staff?
Tell us how you learned this information about the states, and are there states that stand out in this process?
Well, so the CDC asked states to prepare by November 2nd a plan to start this distribution process. And the reason that this goes through the CDC is it's kind of modeled off of the process that they use to distribute the flu vaccine every year. But obviously, this is going to be a much larger scale. And so what we saw in reviewing all of these plans from all the states that we could get, which was almost all of them, is they don't have it all figured out quite yet. And, you know, in some respects, that's okay, because the vaccine isn't here yet, and it's going to be a little while longer before it is. But also, there are so many missing pieces and so many moving pieces that they really are not at the place of readiness where people would probably like to see them be. And you know, some states kind of, frankly, kind of just punted and left it up to more local jurisdictions to figure it out and report back. And, you know, you could see differences, like some states went ahead and did the analysis of who all their critical populations are that they're going to prioritize, how many people there are and where they are, whereas other states just kind of said, well, here are the data sources that we're going to use to do that analysis, but we haven't done it yet. So you could see, you know, the difference by looking at, by comparing the states, you could see kind of how seriously different states were taking it and how far along in the process they were. And you could also see how different states were dealing with the peculiarities or the special circumstances of their states, depending on, you know, how urban or rural they tend to be, how big or small, and what kind of medical infrastructure they're starting with.
One of the things you write in the piece is that distribution of this type of thing is a multi-layered process. And is that what you're talking about, or can you elaborate further?
Well, multi-layered meaning that initially they're focused on vaccinating healthcare workers, essential workers, and people who are most high risk, and then broadening it out to the general population.
So you talked about the CDC. Talk about the role of the Trump administration or Operation Warp Speed or the task force. Do any of those forces or any of those entities have direct input in how a state distributes vaccine?
So, I mean, there's kind of a misconception about the extent to which the military is going to be delivering these vaccines, because those are the terms that President Trump likes to talk about it in. But that really is not representative of how this is going to work. And military personnel are not going to be touching the vaccine between the factory and people's arms. So the military was, the Department of Defense was deeply involved in Operation Warp Speed on the logistical planning and manufacturing supply chain side. But once these vaccines start actually going out the door, that's not a DOD function. That's where it goes into this pipeline that I was talking about with the CDC and the states. So, you know, another one of the problems that jumped out in a lot of these plans is the federal government is going to deliver the vaccine to the states, but only once. And after that, it's the state's responsibility. So if the state figures out that, well, actually there are some places in the state that can't take these 1,000 dose packages, and the state needs to break them down into smaller bits to send them out to more remote places, that's the state's problem. They've got to figure that out on their own. So first of all, that's hard because of all the handling requirements, but also that's going to be expensive, and that's money that the federal government is not providing. And actually, the federal government has only given states a total of $200 million for this distribution effort, even though the CDC director estimates it's really going to cost closer to $6 billion. And that money just Congress has not approved.
So for the states that have to meet that money requirement, what are the options for them at this point?
A lot of them are hoping that Congress is going to come through with additional funding. But otherwise, I mean, this is another area where they just don't have answers right now.
When it comes to those rural populations that you spoke about earlier, particularly what states stand out and what's facing those populations in particular?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things is, a lot of these states are places where the virus is really out of control right now. So North Dakota is one that sticks out in my mind. Obviously, you know, not a huge population in that state, but a very serious outbreak. You know, one out of about every 1,200 people in North Dakota has died of the coronavirus. And their health department did a very thorough job. It was one of the more thorough reports that I read, and identified all the things that in their experience with H1N1, all the things in North Dakota that make distributing a vaccine really hard because of how geographically big the state is, and the limitations of the transportation infrastructure and the medical infrastructure. Also, there's a large population of oil workers in North Dakota that don't count in the official population. So they don't know if they're going to get enough vaccine to account for all those people. And what if those people are there for the first dose, but then leave before they're supposed to get the second dose a month later? So the North Dakota was an interesting report for that reason, that they were really seriously grappling with a lot of problems unique to that state. But again, you could see that they were trying, but there were a lot of things they still have to figure out.
Isaac Arensdorf wrote the piece for ProPublica. Most states aren't ready to distribute the leading COVID vaccines is the headline. Mr. Arensdorf, if people want to find this piece online, where can they go?
ProPublica.org.
We thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
At the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, the Great War ended. At 5 a.m. that morning, Germany, bereft of manpower and supplies and faced with imminent invasion, signed an armistice agreement with the Allies in a railroad car in France. The First World War left 9 million soldiers dead and 21 million wounded, with Germany, Russia, Austria, Hungary, France, and Great Britain each losing nearly a million or more lives. In addition, at least 5 million civilians died from disease, starvation, and exposure. Ultimately, the war that was slated to end all wars led to World War II. But today, we remember those we've lost in all wars. In 2018, we spoke with Karen Durham Aquilera, Executive Director of the Army Cemeteries and Army National Military Cemeteries. We begin with an all-too-familiar song played daily at Arlington National Cemetery.
Thank you. taps at Arlington National Cemetery, part of the solemn ceremony that takes place every day at Arlington. As you hear that, what comes to mind?
Well, thanks, Steve. I never remain unaffected by the playing of taps. No matter how many times I hear it and all the dedicated men and women that serve at Arlington. Anyone that comes there will hear that several times a day. It is played at every single military burial that we do. And then also at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, whenever there is a wreath laying, you will hear taps played as well. So it's a very solemn reminder of the respect and the dignity and honor we provide to our veterans and our patriots.
As we commemorate veterans this month and the end of World War I, let's take a step back, if we could. Before Arlington Cemetery, where were your soldiers buried?
Well, there were very few military cemeteries at that time. In this area, there were two cemeteries, one at the Old Soldiers and Airmen's Home. So that cemetery is even older than Arlington National Cemetery. And there was also a cemetery in Alexandria. So during the Civil War in 1864, Arlington National Cemetery became a cemetery for the military. And the reason for that is during the Civil War, the U.S. government or the Union seized the grounds that originally belonged to Mary Custis Lee because it was the highest point of defense around the Capitol area. And then with time, it was established as a military cemetery.
As you walk through the cemetery, see the tombstones, what goes through your mind?
There are over 400,000 people laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. There are Americans there and their eligible family members from every single conflict that this country has been involved in, every single one. And so there's the past of how Arlington National Cemetery came to be, you know, and then there's the recent past and the current, where we have veterans today, again, from every conflict, including those that have been discovered and identified, and then those that are serving in the current conflict. So there's a huge mix of veterans and patriots that have served this country.
Karen Durham-Aquilera, she is the executive director of Army Cemeteries and Army National Military Cemeteries, and she was our guest on The Weekly back in 2018. You can find the entire podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for joining us here today at Washington Today. If you've missed any part of this program, remember you can listen to it wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.